Robin Hood Radio welcomes you to David Freeman's Science Insider with your host, the senior science editor of the Huffington Post, David Freeman.
Hello, everyone. Tonight we're talking about Alvin, and I don't mean any singing chipmunk. Alvin's the name of the country's most amazing deep-sea research submarine. In fact, I believe it's the nation's deepest diving manned sub. There is one of the deepest diving subs in the world. It can go down about 4,500 meters. That's almost 3 miles down to this crazy kind of a sunless, high-pressure world that otherwise would be off-limits to humans. Anyway, here to talk about Alvin is Bruce Strickrod, who is an engineer who is also Alvin's head pilot. He's made about more than 300 dives on Alvin. And so, hi, Bruce. Welcome to Science Insider.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
Fine. Good. Thank you. So I want to ask you all about Alvin and some of the lore about the submarine, including some of these kind of amazing missions. I understand that Alvin took people down to the Titanic in 1986, and also this is kind of scary. I was reading that in 1966 Alvin helped recover a hydrogen bomb actually that had fallen to the ocean off of Spain. So that was, as I said, that was way back in '66. So Alvin is an old sub, but it's just coming off a $41 million super duper renovation. I think 2 or 3 years. So it's pretty much a brand new sub. So anyway, before we get to talking about some of these missions and what it's like to make a dive down there, Bruce, can you tell us give us a brief overview of the sub itself? How big it is, how it's different from a conventional sub, how deep it can go, what it can do when it's down there. So what's a thumbnail sketch of Alvin?
Well, I'll tell you about the Alvin that we've just pulled out of the hangar, which we pulled it out in May of last year and spent the better part of the end of last year doing all of our sea trial work, getting it ready to get back to doing science. Alvin's about 23 feet long. If you stood on top of it, you'd be about 9 feet off the ground. We enter in the top of the sub. The front half of the submarine is a 6-foot diameter titanium sphere, and that's where all the people go. And then the whole rest of the vehicle is mostly equipment and batteries that make it go up and down. How is it different than a conventional submarine? Well, first of all, it's small, and you can only get 3 folks inside of it. It's not intended to spend more than, on an average day, one day underwater. It can stay underwater for 3 days. It has
3 days.
A mother. 3 days if we had to. So we on purpose carry a complement of 3 days worth of life support systems so that if we had to spend time on the bottom, extra time we could. Our longest dives have been in the neighborhood of about 12 to 14 hours, and those are purposely planned to do interesting work. The submarine, it's sort of iconic. If you look at it, it has a very unique character to it, and the new sub even more so. I'm looking at a picture right now, which I'll be forwarding to you guys. It's got a crab-like look to it. I think it's really cool. It's one of the coolest looking machines I've ever seen, frankly. That's my opinion. It's purpose-built to go deep. That's the key here.
Mm-hmm. And you say it's crab-like because, in part, it's got arms on the front and so on that can manipulate things at depth, correct?
Yeah, it's got a little bit of a character to the front of it. I mean, it's got these 3 big windows up front that make it look like it has 3 eyes, and then right above 2 of the windows are these special high-def cameras that we've just installed, and they give them a little bulbous kind of a look, and then these 2 big arms out front which can articulate and move around. So I suspect that when we go down there and we arrive to some of the larger animals that have eyes that actually work, and we have all the lights lit off and the arms out, they were pretty intimidating.
So I know it's a bit before your time, obviously, but can you tell us about the hydrogen bomb accident?
I can tell you a little bit about what I know. There was a recent book written about it, and it's a fascinating story. Bear in mind, in 1966, the sub was really brand new, so the technology really hadn't been exploited very well. And when you read the stories of what the fellows that were inside of it were dealing with, it was a bit of a competition between Alvin and some other submersibles, and they never knew which one was actually going to find it. There were 4 atomic bombs that were lost. These are hydrogen bombs, mind you, the big ones.
Right.
And they knew where most 3 of them were, but one of them was hard to find. And basically, the guys were down there mowing the lawn on the mud trying to find this lost bomb that hadn't just been jettisoned. It had been part of an accident where 2 aircraft had collided. So I always try to remind myself what it would have been like in there when you come stumbling across this hydrogen bomb that you really don't know what its condition is. You just know it's there. And they didn't really have any nav. It was all primitive. And they could only stay down for the day, and then they would come back up. And needless to say, there was probably a lot of stress on shore, because it's not a good day when the military loses hydrogen bombs.
No.
But I just imagine what it was like to look out the front window when they found it the first time. It was wrapped in its own parachute. Luckily, when it fell out of the aircraft, the parachute deployed. Mm. And they didn't get it that day. They actually lost it, because they had to come back to the surface, and they had to go back through the process and find it the second time.
Wow.
Go
ahead.
Well, I mean, just imagine yourself looking out the window of a submarine that's brand new, staring at a hydrogen bomb, and asking yourself the question, now what?
And what was that? They retreated with the arms, or they tied a rope to it and it was hoisted up? Is that what happened?
I believe that they found it, and from there on, the submarine didn't do the recovery. They brought in Navy assets to recover the actual weapon. There's some good pictures online of it sitting on deck.
Wow. So, and I want to ask you too about the Titanic, but before that, also, I think one of the big scientific missions for Alvin was the discovery of these smokers, these underground vents back in the 70s. That was kind of a big discovery, wasn't it?
Well, I think it was a monumental discovery from the point of view of science, because there had been all sorts of arguments about what sort of life forms they find on the bottom. And when you read some of the history of it, a lot of it was just done with dredges, so they would drag things around. And early on in science, they assumed that there wasn't enough food or anything, and it was basically a big lifeless area. And when they found the vents, they learned otherwise. And from talking to some of the folks that were actually on those dives, when they arrived at the first vent sites, they had temperature instruments that were designed for the ambient temperature, which is really cold, and they promptly put them in the water and melted them. So they knew right away that they were in new territory. And
wow.
And you know, I've had the opportunity to be on dives where people's careers have changed because of discoveries. And I suspect that on that particular cruise, the energy was pretty amazing. I mean, people's careers shift on a moment when they have these discoveries, and then the knowledge of the overall sort of processes on the planet are really affected by these unique opportunities. So I would have loved to be a so to speak, a fly in the hall, you know, looking out the window with them going, look at that.
Well, yeah, just speaking of looking at that, the other thing that I think Alvin is best known for is a dive, I believe it was 1986, going down the Titanic. And so if people have seen the movie Titanic, is that kind of a sense of what it's like, or what it would have been like to see Titanic down there?
Well, okay, once again, I wasn't there for that, but I'm kind of speaking through some of my colleagues that were there and what they've told me. Bear in mind that the year before they had gone with a towed camera called Argo and found the Titanic. So that was the first step, was actually locating it. And then when they were down there, they were testing out some new technology. If you look at the Geographic specials, which you can still get online, they brought a little vehicle called Jason Jr., which was a little remote vehicle that actually was piloted from inside the submarine and flew off the front of the basket, and they flew this thing in the wreck, and they really had a great opportunity to get in and look at some things. At the time in the 80s, they were really working with new video technology. So it was sort of state-of-the-art. And the sub had gone through a major upgrade to change its propulsion so that it was more maneuverable. There's some great artwork that was created after the fact that was in the Geographic magazines, and really gives you a perspective of what it's like to be in this little 23-foot submarine parked on the greater two-thirds of a 1,000-plus-foot vessel that's on the bottom of the ocean.
Right. Yeah, I want to talk about what it's like to be, down in the sub. But I just want to say, a couple of years ago, Alvin is owned, I believe, by the Navy. It's operated by Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. I was there, spent a week there a couple of years ago, and while I was there, I was shown the pressure hulls. That's the big sphere, or maybe not so big sphere. Which serves as the crew compartment, protects the people from the pilot and the scientists from the incredible pressures. And I was amazed that these spheres are pretty small, and also they're manufactured in an amazing way. Can you tell us about why that pressure hull is so important and how it was made?
Sure. Well, I think it's fairly obvious that the biggest job of the sphere is what one of our ex-pilots named Blue Williams would say, to keep the big O out of this people sphere. So we're on the inside, and we carry our atmosphere with us, and we basically encapsulate what it's like to be on the surface. And it's the titanium strength and its design that gets us down there and keeps us safe. And you probably, if you were lucky enough, and again, I'll send a picture of this, of the two spheres next to each other, the one that we retired that had been over 4,000 dives and the one that we had purpose-built for the new vehicle. And without going into all the details, the one that was built, that was retired, was built in the late 60s, early 70s, and was a prototype of titanium manufacturing made out in Mare Island, California. And it was effectively hand-welded, and it took a long time for them to get it well done and then tested and installed. And its success is a testament of the work that they did back then. The new one is also very state-of-the-art, and rather than hand-weld the thing, they actually shot a beam of electrons through the pieces they were welding and rotated this big assembly relative to this beam of electrons, and there was the margin of error was almost zero. And the ultimate result is this really, really perfect sphere. And the measurements done after the fact, after it was all done and measured and treated, show that the thing is almost perfect. It was well within the required tolerances. So we have high confidence that the sphere is exceptional. And the
reason it's a sphere is because that's the strongest shape to keep to withstand the great pressure at depth, right?
It is. And when you look at all the factors that come into designing a submarine, such as weight and material costs and all those things, you can build different shapes, but then you have to really change the design such that they can handle the pressure. Something that's oblong has the pressure applied to it isn't as balanced as a sphere. The nice thing about a perfect sphere is that all around that sphere there's almost equally balanced forces that tend to cancel out.
And so, and there in the sphere, obviously, there are lots of cables that are going through the sphere, and there are also, I believe, five smallish windows through which the scientists and the pilots can look. And I guess all those are concerns. Those are also places where there might be a leak. What would happen if you were down at depth and there were a leak or a crack in the sphere? What would the result be?
Well, let's start with the fact that doesn't happen, okay? And the reason I say that is based on experience, but also because of the physics of the design. So the design of the sub, including the amount of safety factor that's put into this, is specific such that we're not even allowed to dive in depths that this is rated to go to. So if we're in an area where the depth of the ocean is past a certain point, we're really not allowed to go there, even if we're not going to that depth. So that in worst case, even if we ended up sitting on the bottom, we wouldn't exceed our depth. Right. The windows themselves aren't as small as they used to be. That's one of the big advantages of the new vehicle is we've got the front windows are over twice as big, so the viewing, and they're overlapping, so you get this great sort of expanded view up front. And then there's two extra windows on the side, which are bigger than the ones we had previously as well. And so each scientist gets two places to look, plus all that sort of overlapping front view. The design itself went through so many processes to verify it. So I have full confidence that it's not going to happen. And the idea of cracks, the most likely thing to happen to a hull like this one is over time when you dive it over and over again, you cyclically load the sphere. Over time, you could potentially have problems. And part of our maintenance requirement is every 5 years we bring it back and we strip it all apart, tear it all down, and go through full inspections of all these welds around and the windows. The windows are pulled out every 6 months, and those hull penetrations you mentioned are pulled out annually. The maintenance list on this vehicle is extensive. It keeps us really busy.
Well, I understand that you've been down there forever, but of course, as someone who's I've dived before, but I've never been on a submarine, and I guess I'm wondering, it would certainly occur to me on a first dive what might happen. If you were at great depth and it did crack, our window were compromised in some way, would it implode instantly? Is that what would happen?
No, the windows are made out of a plastic, and even if they were to start to have problems, they wouldn't fail like glass. They wouldn't shatter. What would happen is you'd see a crack slowly start to propagate. Even if you could see it, chances are it wouldn't even show until you got back to the surface.
Right.
Because it's when the sub dives, the pressure actually pushes the windows into the hull. So that's an unlikely thing. And, you know, we're talking about in a person's mind, the worst case scenario as far as diving. That's the least likely of all of them. There are other things that could potentially happen. But even with the worst case, which, let's say, entanglement, you're still inside of a fairly safe place. And we have a lot of contingencies to deal with problems like that. And first and foremost is highly trained pilots that make good decisions and don't take us into areas where we can have those sorts of problems.
And you mentioned that Alvin is not allowed to dive in water that's deeper than its writing. So it can't go down to the deepest part of the ocean, the Mariana Trench. I think it's about 11,000 meters or so. When you get fully certified later this year, you go down to a maximum of 4,500 meters. Is that correct?
This particular version of the vehicle, which is the first half of the full upgrade, will go to 4,500 meters. We were excluded from doing the 4,500-meter dive because at the time we were in the area we were diving, the Navy was busy doing things and told us promptly to get out of the way. So we didn't have that one opportunity. We're diving close to 4,000 meters right now. Mm. The deepest part of the ocean, the sub isn't designed to go there, so we would not go there. We can, like I said, if we can go to areas where the depth is no greater than the rated depth of the normal rated, not the extended safety factor depth, but the normal depth of 4,500 meters.
And what do you have a sense of what percentage of the ocean floor you could reach in Alvin?
I think currently we're about
80%.
When we finish the 6,500 meter upgrade, we'll hit close to, I think it's something like 98%.
You mentioned entanglement is, I guess, a more realistic concern. Obviously, there are not many subs that could make it down there. So if you got seriously entangled, is there a way is there a kind of an ejection capsule or anything that you could ride up, or would have to wait for another sub to get there?
Well, let me go through this real quick. We used to have the ability to release the front end of the sub, which is the personnel sphere. That was the previous submarine's hull. And we've taken that capability away because it had a lot of inherent problems that we weren't really happy about. And what we've done is we've replaced it with releasable thrusters. So the majority of the thrusters on the sub, you can actually pop them off. So if you were to suck up a line or a net, you could jettison the thruster and move away and then come back to the surface. There's all sorts of redundancies built into the sub as well. Things like you can release the manipulators. Let's say a manipulator gets stuck. The science basket area with all that gear out there, that can be dropped off. We can release the batteries, drop them out if that was a problem. And then on top of that, on board the Atlantis, which is a support ship, we have a vehicle that we're calling the observation and assist vehicle. It's essentially a low technology, moderate technology remote vehicle that is on the fiber optic cable that we can use with Jason, which is resident on board the ship, the winch itself. And we can actually put this vehicle down there and take a first look at problems and then develop a pretty good response to what we would do, including having a package of really, really high-strength line that we can bring down and latch into the submarine and pull it to the surface. So with the new vehicle, we have a whole much better plan, I think, to deal with that sort of problem. Right. And again, it's not something that's really ever happened, and that's a testament to the training and the requirements that we have when we go underwater.
Well, can you take us through a kind of a typical dive, starting with the preparations you make beforehand? I'm sure it's very, very complicated, but maybe a kind of a thumbnail sketch of what that's like, the preparations and the dive itself, how it unfolds.
Right. Without going into the early part, the preparation for diving actually starts about 2 years in advance with the scientists coming out, getting prepared to get out to the sub. But let's say it's actually the day of the dive. We've been out at sea for a couple days. We've done a lot of work with the folks beforehand. The morning of the dive for the crew of the submarine starts at about 6 o'clock in the morning. It takes us about 2 hours to prep the sub. And that's a full group of guys and girls working around the vehicle to get it ready to go in the water. We have a huge list of checks. It's something like 18 pages long. And they all have to get accomplished to prove that the vehicle is ready to go. The whole time that that's going on, the scientists are out working on the front of the sub, finishing up all the equipment installations and making sure all their experiments are ready to go. And then at about 7:30 in the morning, we roll the sub out of the hangar and we position it underneath the big launching platform and hook it up. And about 9:45, we load the folks in there with the pilot. And a few minutes before 8 o'clock, we'll get the permission to seal the hatch. And the sub is essentially ready to go. The pilot will let the captain and a person on the back deck called the launch coordinator, let them know that they're ready to launch. And by 8 o'clock in the morning, we like to be in the water and on our way down. And we've got it to the point where that's a pretty routine thing. So normally every day we'll be in the water diving at 8. On average, it'll take us about 2 hours to get to the bottom, which is a real fun time because there's all sorts of stuff going on the way down, just sort of getting used to the vehicle if you're new, finding out where the sub is in the navigation, and then landing at the site you want to start at. And then on average, you get about 6 hours on the bottom, and it goes by a lot faster than what you would think 6 hours feels like. The dives are so intense, both in the experience sense, but also with all the work we're doing, that by the time it's time for us to come back, which is normally about 3:30 in the evening, afternoons when we depart, you still have more work to do. And then when you do the ascent, which is sort of the follow-up where we're just making sure all the equipment up front's secure and the scientists are reviewing their notes and communicating that to the folks on the ship so that they're ready to receive the samples. And then about 5 o'clock, pretty routinely, we're on the surface, and a half an hour later, we've been recovered, brought back on the ship. And the scientists then attack all the samples, and they'll spend, on average, all night long working on them. Mm. And we spend the evening getting the sub ready for the next day.
And what sort of contact do you have with the surface when you're down there?
Okay, this is a requirement. We have a device that we call it's called the EDO. We can also call it the underwater telephone. But basically, it's a device that's a lot like a radio, only it uses sound. And you can hear my voice would be just like it is now. The only difference is it's being carried on a sound wave. And we have a requirement to maintain comms with the sub and the surface at all times. So every half an hour at a minimum, we talk to each other and make sure everything's going well. And if we were to lose communications, we do have some backups, but if we were to lose full communications, both the ship and the folks in the sub know that the dive has to end because of that. So that is a requirement.
Right. And what's it like in there? And you talked a bit about there's a lot of stuff going on when you're on the way down and while you're down there, of course. How are you situated? Are you lying down? Are you sitting in a chair? What's it like in there? And how do you eat? How do you go to the bathroom?
Oh, these are great questions. So step one is let's talk about the ergonomics, because that was a big decision about the interior of the new vehicle. We changed the configuration of the windows and we started talking about what we wanted to do inside. The end result was sort of a brain trust of the pilots and the engineers and some of the users to figure out what would be the most comfortable and effective layout. And the pilot sits on a very small seat. That's nothing new. They get the least comfortable seat. They're parked up front. We've made some modifications to make it better, but let's just say it's not the most comfortable place to sit for 8 hours. The observers have sort of a sloped leaning platform where they can lean back against the sphere, which is fully padded, or they can lean forward and look out the window. And it's sort of it's a shared area up front, so people move around a little bit just to make sure that they're not on top of each other. The sphere is 6 inches bigger than the old one, so it's a lot more expansive, believe it or not. We don't lie down. You could kind of just imagine a big round chair with three people sitting in it, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of a shared, cozy, and it's all padded. It looks really high tech now. We have all of the new controls are all laid out, and the lighting is really high tech. And we have three primary screens up front, which is where the pilot interfaces with a lot of the equipment. It's really, the interior sort of experience is a wow factor. We bring kids in there to show them what the sub is like, and almost routinely the word wow pops out of their mouth as soon as they get in there.
And does it get hot in there? Does it feel claustrophobic? What's it like in there?
Well, not to me, it doesn't. And again, most of the people that get in there, I think one of the things that people don't realize is as soon as you get underwater, you stop thinking of the fact that you're underwater, and particularly when you're flying above the bottom of the ocean floor, you really start to talk. The language, if you listen to it on the audio, people are talking as if they're in the air. They even use the word air because of the whole experience doesn't really reinforce that you're underwater. You have to remind yourself sometimes. It's not claustrophobic. It's very, it's cozy. You said, is it warm? It can start off warm. The temperature will drop during the dive down to about high 50s on an average dive. So it's cool. People put on sweatshirts and sweatpants, and there we bring blankets with them, special blankets that come in the submarine, so when people get a little bit cold, they can wrap up. But it's a very pleasant experience. Most people that go in there for the first time, when they leave, they will never forget it.
And you're eating down there, I guess, and what about going to the bathroom? Presumably you'd avoid liquids or something for some period before you go down, is that right?
Well, we don't advise that because that tends to make people dehydrated. We really encourage them to have a normal day. Granted, there's some planning here, right? The last thing you want to do is have to go in the submarine, but it's a pretty routine event. And we have, without going into details, let's just say we're prepared for any of them.
Well, can you give me some details?
Okay.
People, they're not wearing diapers, for instance, right there.
No, that would be kind of uncomfortable. No, we have, when people have to urinate, we have little bottles that we carry, and we can actually make it very private. With the selective use of blankets hanging up, and it's a common occurrence for people to drink coffee in the morning and have to get rid of it halfway through the dive. That's pretty common, and it's not. I think it's an imagination thing. People can make it into worse than what it really is. It's like going on a road trip, so with no rest stop other than what you're carrying along with us.
Right. Do you have, of all the hundreds of missions you've made, is there one that stands out to you as the most exciting or the most or most unusual?
Well, I would say that, I mean, as far as excitement, the first time I actually had to sub by myself and was the pilot in command on my own, that was an exciting day. I wasn't a very effective pilot. New pilots tend to be pretty clunky, but the first time you get the sub on your own is an exciting day. I've had a lot of dives that I remember as being really memorable. One is more than one dive is to a place that we used to call Tube Worm Pillar, which is down in the middle of the Pacific. And it was a 40-meter tall basalt structure that had a hydrothermal vent that grew up in the middle of it. And it was covered from top to bottom with the giant tube worms. And I've been there enough times where even senior scientists that had seen it before were thoroughly blown away every time you visit this place. And unfortunately, in 1996, there was an eruption and Tube Worm Pillar is gone.
Well, tell us about these tube worms. You said they're giant tube worms. How big are they? What do they look like?
Well, the ones I'm speaking of are called Riftia, and on average, if you were to take one and lay it on a table, they're about 5 feet long. They're in a tube that the animal actually creates. That's probably an inch and a half cross-section, and the worms come out the top, have a big red plume, which they use to filter the nutrients out of the water that they live in. They live in about 20 to 25 degrees C water, which is around where the hotter water is, the localized super hot water, and then all this diffuse flow. So, and these worms in particular, once they pick a place to live, they're there. They're not mobile except for in and out of their tubes. But they tend to live in huge groups, and then they become sort of the local large fauna, and then all the other things that are there live in and amongst them. So there's all sorts of little tiny animals, and there's crabs, and you can literally sit there, and we don't really just sit there and stare at things because we're so busy doing other work, but you could spend a whole day just observing them because there's so much going on, even in a little 4x4 square area that you're looking at. There's so much life there. It's really amazing.
So how many pilots are there?
Well, I mean, currently we've got about 4 active pilots that are diving the submarine, and we, on a given cruise, we'll have like 3 to 4, and we rotate out every day. So you're not diving every day. That would be sort of exhausting, and we try to keep it so that we're not diving every other day. So on a good cruise, we have 4 pilots, and we have another 4 or 5 technicians on board that are almost all training to be pilots.
And as Alvin is owned by the Navy, which presumably means that it's doing work for the Navy as well as you're doing scientific research, how does that work?
Well, the Navy does own the vehicle, and they also own the ship that we operate on. They own the Atlantis. They give us the full responsibility of the vehicles. And we do occasionally do work for the Navy, but it's not a common thing. The Navy has their own, we don't do the salvage work for them. They have their own contract with other companies to do that. I think more than anything, we represent the Navy, and we certainly are overseen by them. But we aren't Navy active people. Some of us are ex-Navy, myself included. We understand the Navy, and we work with them hand in hand. That doesn't mean that if they wanted to come and use us that they couldn't. They have that full authority to do so.
Right.
We really are there to work for science.
And we have only about a minute and a half to go. Where is Alvin now, and what's next for it?
Well, Alvin is currently on its way to New Orleans. It just left Panama, where it dropped off the last group of scientists who were on an ROV Jason cruise. When Alvin arrives in New Orleans, most of us are going to fly down there and meet the ship. And we're going to be showcasing the sub and the ship at the Underwater Intervention Convention, which is there from February 11th to the 14th. We have private visitation on the ship. The ship will, however, be parked along the pier near the New Orleans Aquarium, and the sub will be out on the back deck. So anybody walking along the pier near the aquarium will be able to see the sub and the ship. And that's their first step. And then right after that, on March 14th, we depart for about a 2-week cruise where we're working the science for the first time with this new vehicle and grooming it for that. And then after that cruise, we start the 3 months of work in the Gulf of Mexico doing the actual science work.
Right. Okay, well, we're about out of time. The fascinating look at Alvin, and we've been speaking with Bruce Strickrout, who is the head pilot of the Alvin, and maybe when they're offline, I'll ask you about how journalists get to go for a ride down there.
Yeah, you'd love it.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
Science Insider with David Freeman, the senior science editor of the Huffington Post, produced in cooperation with Robin Hood Radio, robinhoodradio.com, on the web.